the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. 1 o'clock at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. Well, in the second part of the show, we'll be doing 10 reasons why Kamala Harris lost on the Savvy Sam show. But we're going to start off with Douglas McGregor, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel from the armored divisions, some of the early wars in the 2000s in Iraq. And he's going to be on the Judging Freedom website with Judge Napolitano. And they'll be talking to the point of Trump and Netanyahu at crossroads. And this was posted on Tuesday, November 12th.
Much appreciated your time and all your thoughts. What do you think is the Kremlin's likely internal truthful reaction to the election of Donald Trump?
Well, keep in mind, first of all, that the Russians understand even less of what goes on in Washington than we understand of what goes on in the Kremlin. So I think there'll be a large number of people who will see this as a wonderful development, simply because it's not Biden, and President Trump has expressed a willingness to settle issues in Ukraine. I think, on the other hand, that President Putin actually does understand much more about us, and I think he's being very guarded in what he says, and I think that's ultimately what the Russians will do. They'll wait and see.
When the president-elect was a candidate as recently as 10 days ago and said he'll end the Ukraine war in 24 hours, I almost can't imagine what he was thinking could possibly happen in 24 hours. He's not going to threaten Putin. Zelensky's not going to give up. Biden is still sending military gear and cash to them until January 19th. And Zelensky still needs human beings, which nobody can really produce for him. Am I missing something?
Well, I think the view from President Trump's vantage point and the people that he's appointing, obviously, collectively, is that we've wasted a lot of money on Ukraine, and we need to end that as soon as it's practical to do so. That's the first point. But I see a desire to maintain or perpetuate hostility to Russia. And you have to look at these various proposals that have drifted out from inside the inner circle. They're all predicated on the assumption that Russia must be an enemy, and that anything that results in a clear and unambiguous relationship with Russia that is not somehow or another at least partially hostile is a failure. So I think that's a problem. I also think there's an assumption, and this is a comment about everything right now with all of the people that are coming into the administration. There is an assumption that we are really in a place not very different from what President Trump left in 2020. And of course, that's fundamentally wrong. The world has actually changed very profoundly. And most of the world, quote unquote, is not afraid of us. I think there's this assumption that we can still threaten and bully. We can still impose sanctions and tariffs and get our way. And I think those days are absolutely over. So it's hard to tell. Frankly speaking, I think they probably want to dump the problem on the Europeans at some point. But I don't think they're willing to say, look, this was a mistake. I think President Trump's appropriate approach is to say, I didn't start this war. I don't want this war. And I want to conclude it. And I will support a proposal that meets, to the extent that it can, everybody's interests and needs. And I think that would be wonderful, but I don't see that happening. I think he's going to come in with some sort of expectation that he's going to profoundly shape what happens. I don't think that's going to happen. Russia is in charge.
What do you think is the reaction, and we haven't heard a peep from them, at least I haven't, of the NATO and EU elites can't be very happy to President Trump's election?
Well, of course not. But on the other hand, I think they're probably eagerly going into their various social media accounts and deleting all the nasty things that they've said about him in the past as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. Will that make any difference? Probably not. I think the truth is that the EU is crumbling. NATO is crumbling. I think the EU will probably go under before NATO does. New governments are coming to power. Germany, which is in total disarray, is going to end up with a new government. And that may be the first of several, as we've seen in Great Britain. Again, you have to look at the economics of the situation. Look at the bond yields in Germany, the bond yields in England, the bond yields here. Despite everybody's efforts to suppress interest rates, those yields are going up. And the underlying fundamentals economically in terms of production, they're just terrible. So, and the banking system is the other piece. So our banks, as a from a systemic standpoint, are 8 times worse off today than they were in 2008. You just have to listen to the financial analysts who tell the truth, that are very open about it. You know, people like Nassim Taleb, I think Gundlach, what's his name, Druckenmiller. There are several others, Michael Ferber. Or Faber, all these people are saying the same thing. They're right. So that's the other elephant in the room, is this enormous debt load in our weak position and the supposition that we can simply print money into perpetuity. All of that's going to come apart over the next few months.
Well, I hope that whatever the outcome of the dispute between the... This is a little bit off our topic, but you've piqued my interest in it. Whatever the outcome of the dispute, the public dispute between President Trump and Fed Chairman Jay Powell is, and whoever the new Secretary of the Treasury is, the printing of the cash will stop. I don't think that's going to happen. It's just a hope. It's just a hope on my part. You know, you mentioned...
Well, not only will that not happen, Judge, there will be no effort to cut spending.
Yeah. Right.
Anyone who thinks so is delusional. And I feel badly for brother Elon Musk, who very childlike is marching into this thing with the assumption that he's actually going to fundamentally change all of that. There's no chance. And
agreed.
I think President Trump has indicated that. Look, he's still talking about tax cuts, you know, for the upper, 10% or 20%.
Trump loves debt. Trump believes that debt is an appropriate instrument to... prosperity. His grandchildren and great-grandchildren might regret that view, but that's very much his view. You mentioned Germany. Trump is of the view, as are we, that the United States destroyed the Nord Stream pipeline. I wonder if that's going to come out. Everybody knows that Joe Biden is lying about this, caused it to be destroyed on his own. Now this might very well be a topic of debate, because they're going to go through either a cold winter or a winter with a lot of respiratory problems because they're burning coal instead of natural gas.
Well, they are going to import a lot of coal, and we've got lots of coal to sell them, and it's good coal. I can talk for hours about that since I'm involved right now with coal and biochar and rare earths and other things. It's not going to save Germany. Germany's problems now are far worse than that. What's happened over the last few years is that we've finally succeeded in implementing the Morgenthau Plan with Germany's, you know, support and assistance. We've deindustrialized it, turning it into a rural pasture, if you will, which was what Morgenthau tried to do under FDR. It's a catastrophe. The Germans are going to wake up. They're already beginning to understand what a terrible position they're in, and they know that we're mightily responsible for it. But remember that Schultz and his friends have all followed us blindly down the path to hell. And that's their problem now. And I think that will be Trump's attitude.
Your Holly.
I know General is the highest.
Sadly.
You know, the Washington Post reported that President Trump spoke to President Putin and asked Putin not to accelerate the war. Now, I could stop by saying the Washington Post reported and put in parentheses, and therefore the CIA wants us to believe this. Dmitry Peskov, who's President Putin's spokesperson, said absolutely not. There's been no conversation that took place. I can't imagine the conversation going much beyond any demand that Trump would make of Putin. Putin just wouldn't sit there and listen to it.
Well, right now I'm afraid that Peskov has a lot more credibility than the Washington Post, or for that matter, anybody who has been repeating the CIA MI6 narratives about the war in eastern Ukraine. So I would dismiss all of that as utter nonsense. If Trump does something like that, I think he's the sort of person who would tell us.
Yeah. How badly is Ukraine going right now? How close to achieving a publicly proclaimed endgame is the Russian military?
Well, the Russian military is close to it, but put yourself in the position of the Russian General Staff. What they don't want is a foolish discussion between President Putin and President Trump on the basis of more promises for which there is no evidence we will ever keep, and surrender anything that the Russians have gained through this war. Where Ukrainian forces, small numbers, drastically reduced in manpower, independent brigades, are being surrounded and then ultimately annihilated, or they're surrendering. I think they want to do that, and they're pressing towards Dnipro. And I think if you're sitting in the Russian General Staff, you're asking the question, where do we want to be by 21 January? And I think they want to be on the Dnieper River. I don't think they want to cross it, because clearly President Putin has made it abundantly clear to everyone that he doesn't want to rule Ukrainians under any circumstances. This is why the myth of the great Russian threat to Western Europe or Eastern Europe is nonsense. He doesn't want to do that. He's a great follower and admirer of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who always argued that Russia should divest itself of all these various states and peoples, non-Russians, and it should be a Slavic Russian state. Putin would like to do so. I see a big emphasis right now. Let's get to the Dnieper River, and then we can decide, based upon what President Trump and his representatives ultimately propose, whether or not we stay there or move further.
I hope that
he can still cross that river into Odessa. There's nobody to stop him.
Right. Well, I hope that President Trump doesn't appoint people, and he seems to be leaning in that direction, who have argued for this absurd domino theory that Joe Biden articulated, that I think I'm quoting the president now, once he takes Ukraine, nothing will stop him from turning towards the rest of Eastern Europe. He has his eyes on Poland. This is absurd. I have heard this from Republicans. I have heard this from people whose names are being touted as potential nominees. It'll be a crushing
yes.
for those of us who have hopes for a more sane, more peaceful, more rational, more realistic foreign policy. If these neocons, if we go from one group of neocons to another.
Well, you know, what President Trump could do, which would be a much more reasonable and rational approach to the Russians, who don't want to be our enemies, who would very much like to do business with us, is to simply say that he will host a discussion or a peace conference or a negotiation between the various parties, primarily President Putin and the East European states. In other words, the people that border Russia, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Finland, Romania, Slovakia, Hungary, all of them, Poland, come sit and talk directly to the Russians, sort this animal out. However, the precondition for the talks is that the United States accepts neutrality for Ukraine, not a term of neutrality that allows for something else in 10 years or 20 years. That's absolutely unacceptable. There will be no peace in Eastern Europe, let alone Ukraine, unless Ukraine, what remains of it, is neutral. If he did that, I think this could come to some sort of closure relatively quickly. But I haven't heard him say those things. We get rumors, so we have to wait for what President Trump actually says. But back again to this notion that we're the great superpower and we can weigh in and force or push the Russians to do anything is nonsense.
Last week, Ron Dermer, who's perhaps the closest advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, I met Mr. Dermer many times. He was born in Miami, educated in the U.S. and Great Britain, had joint Israeli-American citizenship, renounced his American citizenship to comply with Israeli law that allowed him get into Netanyahu's inner circles, visited Moscow secretly. What do you think that's about, Colonel? We know that Israel is on the brink of economic chaos, and we know that it is surrounded by enemies with whom it has picked fights that it can't seem to win. But what would Dermer be looking for from the Kremlin?
The truth is that Israel is on the path to war with Russia, as well as Iran, Syria, and potentially any number of other countries, including all of the Arab states in the peninsula in Egypt. I suspect that he went there hat in hand with some sort of attempt to get forgiveness for having launched airstrikes against Russian facilities in Syria, and hoping that the Russians would tell them, you need not worry, we will not attack you. And I don't think he got that. As far as economic assistance is concerned, why would the Russians give them any and help bankroll them, since they become, from the Russian standpoint, a menace to stability and security in the region? We're financing Israel right now and keeping its society and economy afloat, but I don't think the Russians have any interest in that. Bottom line is, I don't think he got much.
Do we know, Colonel, if Russia and Iran signed a mutual defense pact?
No, I can't confirm that there was such a thing. There may be, who knows? But frankly, I don't think it's very meaningful to concern ourselves with it. Iran is this enormous country of almost 100 million people. It is a major powerhouse in the region. Russia is not going to allow Iran to be pulverized and reduced to rubble by us, because that's the only way it could happen. If we intervene directly on the side of Israel, which looks increasingly like it will happen. So bottom line is, this is a terrible situation. If I would say anything about the collective appointees right now, Judge, I would say that the announcements of all of these people thus far are interpreted, certainly in Iran and the rest of the Muslim world, in Arabia, the peninsula, Egypt, and elsewhere, that war is now imminent and it's inevitable. And so everyone is quietly preparing for that inevitability right now. And I think we will see this war blow up in a major way before Inauguration Day.
Colonel, if you look at the voting records of the people reported to have been appointed when they were in Congress, and they're all still in Congress, that is a rational conclusion. And
yes,
if you look at what they've said on the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate, without mentioning any names, that is a rational conclusion. You and many other people on this show have concluded that for a variety of American domestic political and financial reasons, Prime Minister Netanyahu has a lock grip on the U.S. government. Will he have the same lock grip under Donald Trump? Can he just do whatever he wants under Trump and still expect 100% of what he asks for, as has been the case under Joe Biden?
I think that's very probable. I don't see any evidence to the contrary. I would take everybody back to the Republican convention when a large sign with an Israeli flag was behind the podium, and it said Israel first. And a gentleman whose name I don't recall walked out, and he had some cheers. He also had people that watched with incredulity. Some people, you know, folded their arms. But I think that was the message. This is an Israel first administration, period. End of discussion. And that's where we're headed. Now, what happens? That will depend a great deal on the initial collisions and who comes into the conflict. And then, of course, people will probably, in many cases, get cold feet quickly. Right now, again, the world view of this new collective coming into power, including President Trump, is that we're the sole superpower. We can do everything. We're masters of the universe. We know everything. Don't bother us with facts. Don't bother us with any advice. We know it. We have this. And we're going to prosecute this as we see fit. End of discussion. I think that's where we are. They don't even seem to understand that you can make nice noises to the Russians in Eastern Europe. And I'm sure they're going to go there with some notion of a grand bargain, which will include a free hand in the Middle East in return for us recognizing Russian territorial gains. Well, that's silly nonsense. There will be no grand bargain. There will be no wedge driven between Russia and China. That's off the table. Right now, it's very obvious that if we go into the Middle East and attack Iran, we will be at war with Russia, period. And China will back Russia 100%.
The three potential or likely nominees announced so far in their congressional careers have described themselves as hawks on China. They've been very bellicose toward China. We can't fight a war against Russia and China and expect to prevail, can we, Colonel?
Well, obviously they think otherwise. There's also a failure to understand the business with tariffs now and the usual American bullying tactics with sanctions. China's total business with the global South amounts to about 1.8 million. The rest of the world, which is really Europe, North America, you look at that and it's a fraction of 1.8 trillion. I think if you include all the Europeans and a few others with us, you might come into 1.4 trillion total, but then you take us out of that. We barely register. I mean, if you look at the bar charts, which were published, I think, in the Financial Times, you know, 90 plus percent of China's business is elsewhere. They don't need us. This is the great fallacy that we're the indispensable nation, which continues under this administration. And that we have leverage. Again, leverage. What's the strategic leverage? It doesn't exist. We have none. But to admit such a thing is an expression of humility that is absolutely unacceptable to this administration, at least thus far.
And humility is not a word that comes to mind when I think of Joe Biden or Donald Trump. But let's get back to Trump and Netanyahu. Here's what Prime Minister Netanyahu said yesterday, cut number 8.
In the last few days, I have talked three times with President-elect Donald Trump. These were good and very important conversations designed to strengthen the covenant made between Israel and the allied countries. We see eye to eye on the Iranian threat in all its forms and the danger it poses.
We see eye to eye on the Iranian threat in all its forms and the danger it poses. Now, I don't know if that's true, but he certainly wants us to believe that that is true of
himself.
Well,
first of all, we don't know whether or not he's actually spoken to President Trump that many times.
Correct.
I mean, he's been deceitful in the past. I don't see any reason to take it at face value now. Again, I urge people to listen to President Trump when he speaks. Now, His basic argument, which goes back to Naftali's characterization of the octopus and the necessity of striking the head so that then you can clean up, presumably, all the little octopus arms all over the region, that stands up to closer scrutiny. And I think that general proposition is well supported by this new administration. And we've already seen, what's interesting to me, I was talking to someone today involved with the bombing strategy against the Houthis. And I urge people to remember that in support of Saudi Arabia, we helped to kill about 500,000 Houthis. Hmm. Well, that certainly had a big impact, didn't it? No. Hmm. And the Houthis aren't out of business. Hmm. And we sent over, as I recollect, B-52s or B-1s to drop thousands of tons of bombs again. It hasn't made any difference. It's not going to make any difference. We can't bomb our way out of this, and Netanyahu can't kill his way out of it.
Do you think Israel is on the brink of collapse, militarily and economically?
Israel without us would collapse. Let's just keep that in mind. Now, how close are they internally to serious problems with their own population? I don't know. I'm not there. I urge you to, I would always defer to someone like Max Blumenthal, who has a much better grasp of what's really happening on the ground in Israel than I do. But from a strategic standpoint, they are overreaching on an Olympic scale, but that's because of us. And now they have an administration that they are confident will do more for them than any other has. And I think there's a great deal of evidence to support their assumption. The question is, once things get hot and we are at war, how long will we persist? Just how far are we willing to go? I don't think anybody knows that yet.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which you and I from time to time read, it reminds everybody that today is the 29th day of Joe Biden's 30-day ultimatum. The ultimatum was allow international assistance into Gaza or we will certify you as non-compliant and that might jeopardize our veto at the Security Council and it might jeopardize our continued distribution of military equipment and aid to you. I think that's nonsense. I'm sure on the 30th day they're going to forget about it or extend it another 30 days.
Nothing else comes to mind that will be treated with greater irrelevance than the UN by this new administration.
Well, Colonel, thank you very much, my dear friend.
Are we going to talk about all the good things?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's rather gloomy.
Well, we're going to get an education soon, I think, when we find out about the plans to secure the border. What are they? How is it going to be done? And I note that Tom Homan, who is a very good and decent man, has been made the so-called czar in the White House. The only problem I have with this term czar is it has no relevance. It has no real authority. It is not a key appointed position that requires confirmation.
Well, it doesn't have confirmation, it doesn't have a staff, and it, most of all, doesn't have a budget.
Yeah, and you're dealing with people whose focus is really external. The Israel First approach really could care less about what happens at our border and what happens inside our country. They simply want use of the American military establishment. So I think Tom Homan is a good and decent man, as I said. I like him very much, but I'm skeptical of it. I have also heard there was a dispute of some kind, or maybe it wasn't a dispute. Somebody got their wires crossed a few days ago. President Trump said that RFK Jr. would be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which I think is a brilliant choice. Although having said that, I'd rather have RFK Jr. as either vice president or secretary of state, but that's fine. Health and Human Services is something he would do brilliantly. But then Howard Lutnick, who is ultimately leading this transition, announced that that wouldn't happen, that he would be quote unquote a health czar. You know, all this czar business goes nowhere.
All they're going to do is give speeches, these czars.
Yeah, sure, of course. And ultimately, what's that mean? Well, it may mean that the pharmaceuticals have called everybody up and said, look, you put him over there, we're at war. I mean, you have the same thing with the Department of Defense. you're going to end up with a Secretary of Defense who is not going to go into the Secretary of Defense office with the goal of fundamentally changing anything. Oh, he may pick on behalf of President Trump some replacements, especially the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and maybe some of the Joint Chiefs. But that's not going to make much difference. When you want to make really positive change, you've got to go after structure as well as personnel. And we have huge problems with that, as we discussed before. 43, 44 four-stars for a force of, what, 1.18 million? It's ridiculous. I mean, we managed to win the Second World War for the most part with 7 four-stars for 12 million. Where it's a banana republic structure right now. It's also an old, antiquated structure. If anything, we should have learned by now that we're living in a very new world, and that world has come to light in eastern Ukraine. We've got to make some profound changes in the way we do business in defense. And then, of course, there's the defense budget issue and the criticality of cutting spending. It's going to become more obvious, particularly once the war starts and we see the markets tank and the economy can't keep up because it's in terrible shape. People will then begin to say, well, where are we headed? Well, we're headed into a storm of unbelievable proportions. You've got debt, financial crises here at home. You have millions of people inside the country who are not Americans, were not born here, have no real interest in becoming Americans. You have more Americans right now at risk of being killed or harmed by Venezuelan gangs than you do in the Middle East, at least at the moment. Nobody talks about it. Nobody's doing anything about it. What we hear is, well, we're going to run the biggest deportation operation in history. Okay, fine. How? Mm. And nobody wants to go there. And these are very important things.
You know, I want
to
get back.
Where does the American military fit into all of this? And
I want to get back to the military. I don't think the
Tom Holman is not really the man to command that kind of operation.
Well,
that's a military operation.
He won't have the legal authority or the financial ability to do that command. Do you think that the president or whoever he's going to appoint to run the State Department has the appetite for curtailing the 850 foreign military installations that the empire has built and funds around the world? Probably not.
No, I mean, just recently I listened to commentators in Great Britain who are not necessarily critical of President Trump personally, but have said this looks like a reactionary imperialist administration. And their argument was there's no evidence for, you know, disengagement from these overseas garrisons, no evidence for disengagement from the conflicts and crises themselves. If anything, they plan to jump in with both feet. I think there's some truth to that.
Mm. Well, time will tell. We probably will learn sooner rather than later. In my world, of course, you would be either the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense, but I don't have any say, just my own vote.
I wouldn't work so far.
Yes, thank you, Colonel. A great treat to be able to pick your brain, as always, and hear you talk about all of this stuff. Look forward to seeing you again next
one
week.
One last point.
Sure.
I heard that they just announced that this Kristi Noem, the governor of, what is it, North Dakota or South Dakota, is going to head up DHS. I was very hopeful, given President Trump's experience, that one of the first things he would do is get rid of the Department of Homeland Security. It's a waste
of
money.
Same here. Same here.
Not needed. So, anyhow.
And he should do the same with the Department of Education. For up to me, half those departments would be gone. They're not authorized by the Constitution, but
nope. That's just me. Absolutely.
Thank you, Colonel. All the best, my friend.
Right. Thanks.
Sure.
Well, that was Judge Napolitano interacting with Colonel Douglas McGregor, retired armor, U.S. Army. Trump and Netanyahu at crossroads. Well, some people question, you know, they have what I consider, from my political perspective, a lot to say about analyzing world affairs, a lot of military affairs, these two. And Judge Napolitano is a probably libertarian, a gold bug. Douglas MacGregor is more conservative, and when they talk about the getting rid of the education department, I heard on this morning's National Public Radio's morning edition, somebody from the Brookings Institution was asked, well, what does the education department do? Well, they said, well, they oversee financial aid loans to college students. Well, that hasn't gone very well. But they also do a lot of money to poor districts around the U.S. because in many jurisdictions, which are all run locally, all the money historically and even mostly today go to the richer school districts or portions of the school districts. So there it is some amelioration of what goes on across the country. And so I disagree with them in that. And Homeland Security, of course, developed out of that fake 9/11 increase of war making around the world. But the I do like a lot of what they say, how they do foreign policy and military things. Somebody accused me of being pro-Russian. Well, when they talk about Russia, they're usually saying, well, Russia is going to win this war in the Ukraine. And what I'm mostly about is ever since the Vietnam War, when during this time I was going to go into the State Department or National Security Agency, I came to see that there was the U.S. was wrong. It took a long time for that, just as it's taking a long time for the understanding of what's going on in Ukraine because of how most of the media presents it to everybody. I think I've gone over in the past how they just give people a script and they read it as to what the history in the Ukraine has been. But I am most concerned about the U.S. wanting to be the unipolar dictator of the world, empire, and to do the one with that. You know, there's a reason why there's 700 bases around the world and all this money is being spent on weapons and all that. That's to fulfill a foreign policy objective of being this single, instead of having a multipolar world, a single U.S. calling all the shots all over and not giving up any account to what the rest of the world wants. Well, anyway, before I get to my next piece, tonight there's a community teach-in. No weapons, no war. And learn and share knowledge about weapons manufacturing operating in Minnesota. Their reach deep into metro areas, the history of resistance against them, and what we can do now. It's going to be tonight at 6:30 at the New City Center, which used to be Walker Church, 31st and 16th Avenue South in Minneapolis. And put on by WAM. And they have a second thing this next few days on Sunday. Rally for People, Planet, Palestine. Money for climate, not for war. A kid-friendly rally. It's going to be put on at Painter Park Sunday, November 17th at 1:30 p.m. So join families against military madness and the Climate Justice Committee during COP29 to rally against environmentally destructive endless wars. There will be kite making, sign making, live music, and snacks. So now I'm going to be going to 10 Reasons Why Kamala Harris Lost. You know, they've been hearing a lot of different things. This is Sabby Sams. Her real name is Sabrina Salvati, and she has some, she's a black woman from, I think, Boston, but anyway. This was posted last week, November 8th. There may be a few squeaks in the mic. I had some problems with, but it's worthwhile listening. She has some different things.
Everybody's talking about it. If you're not talking about it, you're thinking about it. Or you were in one of those meltdown videos where you were one of the people screaming. I made a list about it. I came up with 10 reasons why Kamala Harris lost. 10 reasons. And I am going to get into it. Now, this is in no particular order. Everybody understand? No order. I got to say this again, just in case people be like, why'd you put that one first? No particular order. 10 reasons why Kamala Harris lost her campaign. Here's the first reason. Celebrity overload. This is one people may not have thought about. Celebrity overload. Whether it was Beyonce, whether it was Usher, Eminem, whether it was Meg Thee Stallion shaking a booty in Atlanta, there was too much celebrity overload. It went above and beyond. It went over the top. And sometimes when that happens, it can give people the impression that you're trying too hard. Where I come from, we say, you're doing too much. You're just doing too much. Feels like a distraction. In fact, I called this out on Twitter. Beyonce, Oprah, J-Lo, Bruce Springsteen, and Taylor Swift couldn't save Kamala. Looks like working class people would buy celebrity endorsements. Who would have thought? So you see, you just can't like this. Working class people don't care about this. People that are trying to pay the bills don't care about that. They don't care about you sitting down with and all these other celebrities. Actually, that's kind of a slap in the face. Yeah, I can't relate to you. So I feel like celebrity appearances and endorsements, I felt much. You don't need to have a celebrity at every freaking rally. That was too much. And yes, we do know that politicians will have a celebrity every now and then, but it was too much. It was all over the place, and it seemed like such a distraction from your campaign. Then you have people showing up to see what they thought would be a Beyonce concert instead of listening to your message, your policies, and your platform. We're really talking much about that anyway. So that's one. Two, Gaza. The Gaza issue. One of the things we know is probably one of the biggest reasons voters begged.
Let there be no misunderstanding. We told our supporters plainly that if they did not share this endorsement, they should still vote third party. Sitting out this election was never an option. This is not a victory speech, but we will not let this moment pass without congratulating the Muslim American community for its unprecedented stand. No minority group in the United States has come together so powerfully to draw a red line, and in circumstances as dire as these in modern history. True courage doesn't wait for permission, and principles are not accessories to be discarded when stakes are high. By holding this line, our community has displayed a rare and genuine integrity, one that shines in the face of extreme adversity. To those who stood by and watched, consider this our condolences. To every person who fancied themselves righteous, To those who postured as morally superior, you have exposed yourselves. For 14 months, you saw the images. Children beheaded, dismembered, orphaned, and did nothing. You saw videos of women torn apart by bombs, gunned down, mourning the erasure of entire bloodlines, and still you did nothing. You saw men crushed to death by tanks, lined up and executed, raped in Israeli prisons, and nothing moved you. Those of you with even a shred of self-awareness will come to realize you lost more than an election. You minimized and dismissed a genocide, funded by your tax dollars, your compliance, and your silence. You didn't just lose the election, you lost your humanity. Spare us the patronizing responses of, good luck under Trump. Our efforts for justice have always relied on people of conscience, and this past year has made it clear you have none. What did you think would happen? Did you really think we'd sit idle while our tax dollars were used to massacre our people, desecrate our holy sites, level our places of worship, and that we'd then vote for the administration responsible for one of the most egregious atrocities in modern history? Did you think we'd stand by as anyone who protested was silenced, beaten, arrested, and degraded? As the letter from Black Muslim American leaders so powerfully stated, the war on Gaza is a war on Islam. The Muslim American community, a diverse body of people from all ethnicities and races, has decided we will not stand down. We tell you what we told your murderous, complicit vice president when she berated anti-genocide protesters at her rally. Your words will not placate us, your fear tactics will not shake us, and your condescending tone does not intimidate us. This fight is far from over. If anything, the last year was just the beginning. The outcome does not change our path. We will continue organizing, mobilizing, and building within our community. We have achieved this much with only a year of effort. Imagine what we can accomplish with 2, 4, or 10 years. We will put in the work, and we will leave the rest to Allah. There are those within our ranks who attempted to mislead our community, rallying votes for Kamala Harris to protect their self-interests. For decades, these thieves and scoundrels have posed as representatives of our community. In truth, they represent nothing but their own greed. Let us take note of who they are and remember. Today marks the beginning of a new era, one where the Muslim American community ensures that the victims of U.S. imperialism are no longer faceless, voiceless, nameless. For the past 25 years, we were led to believe that staying quiet and keeping our heads down would keep us safe. The tragic attacks of 9/11 happened. We condemned it, yet we were not spared. The illegal invasion of Iraq happened. We stayed silent, yet we were not left alone. The entire region was destabilized. A vacuum opened, and chaos was unleashed on our people, and still the world pointed to us and demanded that we condemn the violence inflicted upon us. It is time for the Muslim American community to rise and reclaim its dignity, its integrity, its humanity, and in doing so, we hope every other minority community in the United States will see our example, draw their own red lines, leverage their votes, and stand for their dignity and humanity. In conclusion, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to guide us to righteousness, to strengthen our resolve to stand with the oppressed, and to grant victory to those who are crushed by their oppressors wherever they may be. Ameen. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh.
He left no crumbs. Everybody take note. All she had to do was call for an arms embargo and a permanent ceasefire, Gaza, and to show you that it was about her. If you look at the other races in Michigan, Harris loses Michigan and Wisconsin, but Slotkin and Baldwin win. Also, Rashida Tlaib won. It was her. That's not Donald Trump's fault. That's not Jill Stein's fault. That is Kamala Harris's fault. And then, number three, the media. The media is part of the reason why Kamala Harris lost. And I say media, I'm talking about corporate media. In fact, they admitted this themselves. The media sat there during this election cycle, and not only did they shame Donald Trump for having a record, being a felon, not thinking about the fact that there are people within the Democratic Party community that could be in that same situation that may also have had records, not thinking about those things, you know? Class issues. The media sat there and they told people that Donald Trump was Hitler. They called Trump supporters Nazis. I'm talking about the Morning Joes, the CNNs. They did all this stuff. They did this. And then when Donald Trump was a shot at, then they're like, well, we don't want anyone to lose their life or anything like that. When they stirred up a lot of the hate and a lot of the divisiveness themselves, the media did that. The media sat there and defended Joe Biden when Joe Biden called Trump supporters garbage. Then he tried to walk it back. We know what he meant. The media constantly lied to the American people. It was the media who made you guys believe this woman was doing better than she was. And the polls were showing she lost the Muslim vote. She wasn't going to win. But the media made you think she was doing so well. She was not doing well. You guys had to come to independent media. You had to come to my channels like mine for me to tell you she was not doing well in Philadelphia. The media even calls out itself. They called out their self for the lies. Listen to this.
This is a mandate. It's won the national popular vote for a Republican for the first time since 2004. This is a big deal. This isn't backing into the office. This is a mandate to do what you said you were going to do. Get the economy working again for regular working class Americans. Fix immigration, try to get crime under control, try to reduce the chaos in the world. This is a mandate from the American people to do that. I think I'm interpreting the results tonight as the revenge of just a regular old working class American, the anonymous American who has been crushed, insulted, condescended to. They're not garbage. They're not Nazis. They're just regular people who get up and go to work every day and are trying to make a better life for their kids, and they feel like they have been told to just shut up when they have complained about the things that are hurting them in their own lives. I also feel like this election, as we sit here and pore over this tonight, is something of an indictment of the political information complex. I mean, we've been sitting around here for the last couple of weeks, and the story that was portrayed was not true. I mean, we were told Puerto Rico was going to change the election. Liz Cheney, Nikki Haley voters, women lying to their husbands. Before that, it was Tim Walz in the camo hats.
And when he says we were told, who told you that? Who told you that Puerto Rico was going to change things? Who told you these things? Where are you getting this information from? From these Democrat strategists? Remember, it's their job to lie. They're supposed to make you think she has a chance when she didn't really have a chance. The media is part of the reason why. The media, I would argue, the way they constantly kept going after Donald Trump and constantly attacking Trump supporters, Scarborough on Morning Joe saying, who raised these people? The way they constantly kept doing that, I would argue that the media probably energized people who probably weren't going to vote to come out and vote against Kamala Harris. Does that make sense? When you look at the data, the numbers are showing you that Trump was able to increase new voter turnout. He got more new registered voters than Kamala Harris did. The media is part of that.
Night after night after night, we were told all these things and gimmicks were going to somehow push Harris over the line, and we were just ignoring the fundamentals. Inflation, people feeling like that they were barely able to tread water at best, that was the fundamentals of the election. And so I think that both parties should always look at the results of an election and figure out what went right and what went wrong. But I think for all of us who cover elections and talk about elections and do this on a day-to-day basis, we have to figure out how to understand, talk to, and listen to the half of the country that rose up tonight and said, we've had enough.
Well, they're not going to do that because that means that they have to leave their cushy studios. They have to get outside of their bubble. But the media is a big part of the reason why Kamala Harris lost. Four, weak economic platform. This is one I think I went over and over. She didn't have the bare minimum economic issues that should have been on the platform. And Bernie Sanders laid out the blueprint for that one. Honey, it's easy. $15 minimum wage, you start with that. It really should be higher. $15 minimum wage, universal health care, single payer, whatever people call it these days. I don't think they call it Medicare for all no more. Universal health care for everybody. Okay? Paid sick and family leave. By the way, these are things, these are issues, with the exception of the health care one, these are issues that are passing in red states. Like, you just did not have, that's the easiest walk you could have taken. Anybody running for office right now through the Democratic Party, you look at the blueprint that Bernie laid out. That's how you energize a young base of voters, too. So all this tax credit, $20,000 tax credit, and if you have a baby in the first year, you get a tax credit for that too, you know, but it's got to be in the first year, first-time home buyer or your first generation, but you got to be one of the two. Ain't nobody got time for all that. You make it easy, you make it simple. 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 Lack of...
Well, we got through four of them, but yeah, I'll play. I think that some of the rest will probably be pretty good. I'll try and do some of that in the future. That was Savvy Sam's show on 10 Reasons Why Kamala Harris Lost. And she posted that November 8th. And this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. And next week will be, 22 hours of fundraiser for Give to the Max Day. There'll be 2 hours of public affairs, Democracy Now! In this show next week, but there'll be a whole bunch of other stuff that'll be happening, and even a party that night. So you'll get more details during the week.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
1941. Europe was entering its second year of World War. Yet even under increasing pressure, the United States remained neutral. Still, the U.S. military was preparing. That year, the Army tapped University of Minnesota physiologist Ansel Keys for a special project. The brass wanted Keys to design a new combat ration that was small enough to fit in a pocket, yet packed a caloric punch. So Ansel Keys went grocery shopping in Minneapolis, picking up a little of this and a little of that, and bringing it all back to his lab where he could tinker with recipes and count calories. When he was finally ready, soldiers stationed at Fort Snelling were brought in to taste test. Their verdict? Yuck. December 1941, America entered World War II after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And 2.5 years later, June 1944, when American paratroopers leaped into the air over Normandy for D-Day, they had Ansel Keys' rations in their pockets. Though by now, the rations had taken on their official name, K-Rations.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at MN90.com.